Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for July 5th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host Bob Bupka. And Robert, I hope you and all of our listeners had a most festive July 4th celebration. I imagine you behaved yourself after getting back from a big-time 80th birthday celebration.
I really did. And to be truthful, the 4th of July was kind of combined with the birthday celebration. As I mentioned, I think on one of the other shows, if not, I'm going to mention it now, the birthday highlighted by receiving a letter from Jack and Barbara Nicholas wishing you a happy birthday in a million years. I never anticipate any honor like that, and just another indication of what a first-class couple Barbara and Jack are, and I'm looking forward to seeing Jack next week when we're at St. Andrews, and he gets that very special award on the Tuesday prior to the start of the Open Championship, joining none other than Bobby Jones and Ben Franklin. We'll leave it at that. We'll have more on that story on future editions of Musings on Sports. But, yeah, it was great. I hope everybody had a safe 4th of July. And, you know, we celebrate this great country of ours, and, mm-hmm. and we're so blessed to be living here. You never can put into words the amount of gratitude that every American should feel, and I think it went over very, very well.
I echo those thoughts. Wonderful country. We have some warts, but a fantastic country that we live in. Hey, Bob, you mentioned the Open Championship. You and Janice are going to be getting on a jet plane to fly over there to Scotland on Saturday. And in a little bit on this particular episode of Musings on Sports, we're going to have a former PGA Tour player, actually a five-time winner, who played in the Open Championship, was low amateur way back in the day, a guy by the name of Danny Edwards. And Danny, whose new book called Driven, chronicles his life not only on tour, but really the big story as the only professional golfer to also steer an automobile to victory in a premier national race. It's really a great story, and Danny was a great guest. We talked with him at the PGA Championship. Before we get to Danny, though, and in preparation for the Open Championship, Tiger Woods is driving back on the golf course again. Didn't exactly show a whole lot in that first round of that JP McManus Pro-Am in Ireland on Monday. It's a process, isn't it, Bob? I know he told the media that he intentionally stayed away from the U.S. Open. He feels so strongly about this 150th Open Championship, wants to be prepared as best he can for this. But he's got a ways to go, Bob, before he's ready to tee it up a week from Thursday at St. Andrews.
Well, he reminds me of an old poker player. He's not showing his cards right now. He was probably operating at about 50% while he was playing at the McManus Pro-Am in Ireland. He's staying over there an additional week. He's going to put all of his eggs in that basket on round one a week from Thursday. He loves St. Andrews. He plays it well. It's very flat. It shouldn't be taxing on him physically. Can he compete right now against the best players in the world? Obviously, that remains to be seen. The only thing in Tiger's favor, Mr. Elbin, is, you know, Tiger has demonstrated to me that, you know, if he gets a sniff and it comes Sunday, watch out. That's all I can say. Can you imagine the magnitude of the story? 150th anniversary of the Open Championship, Tiger Woods wins his 16th major. A major that he promised he was going to give me while we were together at the PGA Championship at Southern Hills in Tulsa. So will Tiger keep his promise? If he does, I'll probably pass out from excitement.
He's pretty good at keeping his promises. And if you do pass out, we'll make sure we have the local authorities to take care of you. That could be quite a sight. Bob, strange disqualification in the first day of that JP McManus. Jordan Spieth, not realizing that his ball on its own counted, he picked it up when he had a tap in, and basically disqualified himself from the professional portion of that. His play still counts for the pro am portion, but kind of a quirky, unusual situation with Jordan yesterday.
Well, I'm sure he's already focusing on St. Andrews, doing a lot of great work, playing at the McManus for charity, and Jordan just totally forgot, picked up his ball, and I think a bigger deal was made of it than really needs to be. I don't think Jordan was too upset at all for being eliminated from the singles portion. He's focusing on that claret jug, I can guarantee you that.
Yeah, and I also neglected to mention, I believe that if Tiger wins at St. Andrews, I think he would become, other than Augusta National, where the Masters is played every year, Bob, I think he would become the first player ever to win the same major championship three times, or a major championship three times at the same venue. So as historical as he is in his thoughts, I'm sure that's part of his rationale as to why he feels, he's going to give this his best shot.
Yeah, and especially when the Open Championship only comes to St. Andrews once every 5 years. Yeah. So if you win it three times at St. Andrews, definitely a ton of longevity.
Yeah, and great history. Okay, so when we started Musings on Sports, Bob, was with the premise that it would be all about great storytelling, and I like to think that we've kept to that. So with you headed to St. Andrews, with the 150th Open Championship coming up, I believe you have an all-time story having to do with you, three other members of the media, an infamous car ride you had trying to get to the home of golf. Please, please share that.
Well, it was a story I'll never forget. You're right about going over to St. Andrews. We got to play some golf, and I was joined by Scott Tully, the longtime assistant for Jack Nicklaus, Dave Shedlowski, one of the premier golf writers in the country, and the infamous and one and only Alex Maselli, who happened to be behind the wheel. We were driving to St. Andrews after playing golf, having a lovely dinner. So it was getting quite late at night. I think it was about 11 o'clock when we get to the final bridge before you get to St. Andrews, the Firth of Forth. And there was a police car in the middle of the road with lights on, and we had no idea what was going on, but we get out and said to the officer, "What's the problem?" And he said, "Oh, we got a jumper up on the bridge." And now it's 11, we're exhausted, and in unison, without any signaling to one another, all three of us yell out, well, four of us, I should say, yell out, "Jump, jump," and no response. So we were informed that we had to go 45 minutes down the road, cross the river, and then come 45 minutes back. Well, we did that successfully. Now it's about 5 in the morning. I see a signpost that said St. Andrews, just 14 miles. And took a big sigh of relief when within the next few seconds the car starts to spin. I hear some strange noises. Next thing, I'm seeing dust and feeling gasoline, and I thought it was all over for sure. Finally, when we come to rest, I climb out of the car, and just like in Hollywood, I look up at the signpost, and it says Hangman's Lane. I said, boy, what a place to go. But anyway, across the street was a milk dairy, went over there, made friends with the milkman that was going to St. Andrews. We all got on the back of the truck, threw our clubs on there, and got to approach St. Andrews that way. And of course, Alex Maselli, for those that may not know, founder of MorningRead.com, which is doing very well. But what a way to come into St. Andrews to cover an Open Championship on the back of a milk truck.
Now, I know you, I know those three other gentlemen, and I could only imagine having been a fly on that milk truck as you guys headed into St. Andrews. Great story. Great story. Hey, by the way, do you have an early favorite for the Open Championship?
Well, sentimental favorite or realistic favorite?
Realistic.
Realistic. I think, wide open as St. Andrews is, and as far as he's hitting that golf ball right now, I think you're going to see Rory McIlroy return to the winner's circle.
Yeah, it would be a very, very popular victory. You know, Tiger's a big story. Arguably the biggest story in sports right now is the defection, and there's no other term to use, of both USC and UCLA from the Pac-12 to join the Big Ten in 2024. Bob, I went to the University of Richmond in Virginia, but my heart's always, from a sports standpoint, I was a University of Maryland fan, went to basketball games with my dad when I was a kid, and I remember in November of 2012 when the Board of Regents at Maryland voted to leave the ACC, the conference that it helped found in 1953, to go to the Big Ten. There were lots of financial reasons that the university almost had to caused them to leave the ACC and go to the Big Ten. And I know for lots of fans of that school, and I've got to feel as well for fans in general, when they see things like this happen, it's there's a sadness there. In the case of Maryland, instead of playing Duke and North Carolina in basketball on January and February evenings or afternoons, you're playing Illinois or Iowa or Indiana. It's just not the same. Look, no one who follows sports at any level in this country should be naive, or is naive, frankly, about the financial implications of that business and the financial pressures that are being felt by the Pac-12 teams are such that for USC and UCLA, I think they looked at it and said, look, we're just better positioned to go and join the Big Ten and leave the other teams to sort of figure it out for themselves in the Pac-12. And it quite literally, for the Big Ten, has created a conference from coast to coast. Rutgers and Maryland on the East Coast, the major schools that have always formed the Big Ten in the center part of the country, USC and UCLA on the West Coast. It's, you know, when Texas and Oklahoma decided to join the SEC, that was seismic. I think this is perhaps equally as big. You're going to see a tremendous amount of shakeout. Ultimately, probably, Bob, you're going to have what a lot of people would refer to as two super conferences in sports at some point. Football is such the dominant revenue generator. Big question of what the University of Notre Dame will do, whether it will remain as an independent or ultimately join the Big Ten Conference. The Big Ten several times has you know, tried to lure the Irish in. But, man, the landscape of college sports, it's just so very different, and the finances are so massive, Bob.
Well, our listeners of musings, certainly fortunate to have you, Kelly. I mean, you have a pulse on what's happening with the NCAA, like no one else. I mean, you've been a close follower of that situation. And, you know, I have limited knowledge, but it's, you know, all I know is of late, there's one word that's become a lot more prominent and one word that's almost disappeared. And the word that's now the most prominent word, whether it be professional golf, whether it be the NCAA, is financial. Mm-hmm. And the word that has basically vanished from the horizon is the word loyalty.
Yeah, it is. It's almost like a bygone era in terms of the use of that word. It's true. And you see that with the transfer portal for athletes in college. And look, I'm not here to say that the old way was the best way at all. I mean, I think the schools had way too much control over the lives of players, of student athletes, who now can certainly, they can do what they want in many ways. If they're not happy in some place, they can get in a transfer portal and try to go somewhere else. It's just such, it's been such a fast and aggressive change. And it's what happens. It's much more, it's such a professional feel to everything related to big time college sports. The very idea of amateurism is almost a sham anymore. But I'll tell you, a guy who was a true amateur back in his playing
just,
days.
Just one second there, Kelly Elbin.
Yes,
I'm
sir.
Not letting you off the hook. I need to know who you think is going to win at St. Andrews.
Xander Schauffele.
Good pick.
Yeah, I really like the pick of Rory because he has been so close. But Schauffele is, you know, Colin Morikawa won it last year. Really good ball striker, very patient, kind of just methodically goes about his way. I think Schauffele is kind of cut somewhat from that same cloth. And you just kind of feel like it's a guy's time to win. I sort of just feel like it is. But I like the McIlroy pick as well. Danny Edwards, you and I talked with him at the PGA Championship, low amateur, a number of years ago when he was at Oklahoma State, when he really was an amateur. Then he decided, in addition to being an outstanding tour player, he wins five times, he befriends Roger Penske, and they end up playing a whole bunch of golf together at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, and Danny starts racing cars. He wins a big national event. I was really kind of impressed with his whole story. I didn't know that much of it going into it, Bob. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy what they have to hear from Danny.
Incredible story, and a story that's probably not told enough. And happy to see that Bob Denny helping Danny out in writing that book, Driven. I had the opportunity to read it. It's an excellent read. You'll find things out that you just wouldn't believe. So Driven, the story of Danny Edwards.
Yeah, Bob's a dear friend of mine from our days at the PGA of America. Did a terrific job with this book. It is an outstanding read. I hope people will consider purchasing the book. They will enjoy hearing from Danny Edwards, and they will hear from him right after these words from our friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Here with Bob Bupka, and Bob, our special guest today is a man who certainly knows his way around major championship golf courses, and he also knows how to drive in the fast lane. Along with my good friend Bob Denny, he's the author of a new book, Driven, The Danny Edwards Story. Danny Edwards, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thank you very much, Kelly. It's great to be here with you and Bob.
And of course, Kelly, we are here at the PGA Championship. Pleasure to meet Danny Edwards for the first time and enjoying our conversation together. I was fascinated, Danny, finding out you caddied in the 1970 PGA Championship, then finished tied for 22nd in the 1982 PGA Championship. Boy, in a span of 12 years, you went from caddy to finishing 22nd. I'd have to say you're a fast learner.
Well, that was a great experience there. We were Oklahoma State freshmen, sophomores, and we came over here and put our name in the hat, and we drew a player, and of course it was the first major championship I'd ever been around. And I drew a club professional from Dallas, Eldridge Miles, and he was really an interesting character. And we got off to kind of an interesting start. He hit his first tee shot to the left of the fairway line, so he was blocked out when we got down there in real heavy rough, about 5 or 6 inches long. And he said, "Well, Danny, what do you think I should do? Should I knock it down under the trees down there in front of the green and just chip it on up?" And I'm looking at that 5-inch grass and thinking, there's no way you can chip a ball, you hit, play it low out of that, it won't even get to the trees. I said, "Well, Mr. Miles, I think you ought to go down there to the, you know, to the tee box, the other hole, and then play a wedge up over the trees onto the green. Maybe you can make a par." So he said, "Well, I think that's a good idea." So he put it down there, knocked it over on the green about 10 feet and made the putt for a par. And he said, "Danny, you and I are going to get along real good this week."
Well, I tell you, somebody else that's going to get along real good. I love talking to somebody that has accomplished something that nobody else has ever accomplished. And I'm talking about Danny Edwards, obviously. He wins a professional golf tournament. He wins the 1982 Greater Greensboro Open. And months later, he wins a national automobile race, the June Sprints at Echard Lake. How did you transition from professional golfer to race car driver?
Well, Bob, it really started as a young boy having a love for cars and sports cars in particular. I knew every muscle car, the make and model, of every one of those cars on the road. And I'd holler them out in the back seat of our car when Mom was driving when I was 14 years old, 15 years old. And she got so nervous and said, "Don't be doing that. Don't yell at that." But I just love cars. And so I always knew that I would probably do some kind of racing because it just really was kind of in my blood. I loved those cars. And so I started the process of going to the driver schools and getting my licenses and then getting a car, running up at Hallett Motor Racing Circuit up here in the Tulsa area, actually. Won a lot of smaller regional races there. But the big daddy of all the sports car races was the June Sprints at Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, on the four-mile road course that the NASCAR cars run on and the Indy cars still run on today. So I had that by that time. I had my own Formula Ford. The Ping Golf Club Company was sponsoring my team. John Solheim happened to come to the race. I invited him, and so he was there. There were 125 Formula Fords that were there and qualified. I had the fastest time, so I was on the pole for the start of the race. And I led every lap and won the race, got out of the car and gave a big shake of the hands to John Solheim and a hug to my crew. And the next morning I boarded a plane and headed to Houston to play the Houston Open Golf Tournament.
Wow, these are great stories. And Bob, you're right. Danny is unique as a PGA Tour player to do what he's done on the racetrack. Danny Edwards, author of the new book, Driven, the Danny Edwards story, is joining us on Musings on Sports. So Danny, your passion for racetrack, for racing cars, it was obvious as a youngster, but you were a self-taught player from a town in Oklahoma where golf, it wasn't even on the radar in Edmond, where you grew up. You went on to, you know, three-time All-American at Oklahoma State. You won five times on tour. You're elected to the Oklahoma Golf Hall of Fame. But Danny, how did it all start to get into golf? How did you gravitate to golf? And I understand you have a good story having to do with a course called Quail Creek. But your entree into the game was not exactly the norm for a lot of kids who went on to become PGA Tour players.
Well, absolutely, Kelly. You know, Edmond, of course, did not have a golf course. As far as I know, there were no golf professionals there. There were no driving ranges there. I was a baseball and basketball player as a kid growing up. Started playing those games in second and grade. So I was pretty athletic. I could run like the wind, and I always wanted to be the fastest guy or climb the tree the fastest and get to the top. And so I was riding my bicycle one day in the summer, hot summer. You can imagine the old football field was hard as a rock. And I had noticed there were a couple of guys and an older fella, occasionally some guys, doing something, hitting some kind of a ball on the ground with these metal sticks. And I had no idea, but I kind of sauntered over there a little closer one day with my bike, and the older gentleman kind of waved at me to come over. So I rode a little bit closer, and he said, "Hey, what's your name?" I said, "I'm Danny." And he said, "Well, you want to hit a couple golf balls?" And I said, "Sure, I'll give it a try." So I whacked. He showed me how to hold the club. And little did I know, this was Mr. E.C. Hafer, who was a retired football coach and has a beautiful sports park named after him in Edmond and has for years. And so I thought it was kind of cool, but I said thanks and got on my bike and rode on home. A week or so later, I was up there again, saw him, and I kind of rode over, and he said, "You want to hit some more golf balls?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I kind of like that. It's kind of a neat feeling to see that ball take off in the air." So that was my start. And I finally asked for a set of clubs for Christmas that winter, got a set of clubs. We were down in Texas at my mom's brother's, who, and he had bought me a set. They gave him $20, and he'd bought a set of clubs at the pawn shop. We went out to the golf course to play my first nine holes. And so we teed off, played nine, and I played pretty good. I shot 43. Now, between the time at the whole high school football field and Christmas, I spent a good bit of time hitting golf balls. My buddy at the other end of the street played golf with his father, and so I hit with his clubs and whatnot. So we came in after the nine holes, and the pro said, "You guys have a good time." My dad had just followed me around. He didn't play. And I said, "Oh, it was great. I loved it." He said, "Well, what'd you shoot? How'd you play?" I said, "Well, I shot 43. And he said, "That's really good." He said, "How long you been playing golf?" I said, "This is the first time I've ever been on a golf course." He looked at me like I was from Mars. So that was my start. And so it became pretty clear to me that golf was my game. You know, at my height, 5'11 at the time, I wasn't going anywhere in basketball in college, but I continued to play basketball, was an all-state basketball player my senior year, and of course won the state high school golf championship, which is kind of an unusual combination. But I just practiced and practiced, and I had a great experience happen at Quail Creek Golf and Country Club. Mr. Ernie Vossler was the head golf professional there, an iconic guy, had played the tour and won tournaments, and he had a little pro junior tournament during the Oklahoma City Open for the top 12 or 13 players in the high school tournament. And that was my junior year, and I'd gotten somehow in that top 13 or 14. So I got to play nine holes at Quail Creek. I played with Harold Henning from Australia. I'll never forget it. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And I just was absolutely enamored and in shock at how beautiful this golf course was. The only places I'd played on were this course called Eastern in downtown Oklahoma City, cost 25 cents and was a disaster. So I finished that, and I thought to myself, I have got to figure out a way to get on this beautiful, spectacular golf course. I mean, this is my future. I've got to get on this golf course. So I would drive my old Volkswagen over on the back side of Quail Creek, which was out in the country in those days, and park on Portland, and I'd walk across this field and look over the fence at the beautiful 11th hole in the backside at Quail Creek. And I'd come back and get in my car with my head hanging down, thinking, how can I get on this? I've got to find a way. So a few days later, I decided I had to do it, even risking getting thrown in jail, because I had beaten Ernie's son, Eddie, in a couple of high school golf matches. And I knew if he found me, he would call the cops and I'd go straight to jail. So it was a pretty big, you know, I was down at the First Baptist Church every Sunday, and you know, sneaking on and trespassing was not something that I was supposed to be doing, but I couldn't resist. So I came back a couple days later, hopped the fence, played 11 through 17, and I was in heaven. I was talking to my caddy. I was seeing the gallery behind the green applauding as I walked on the greens, making that putt on the 17th hole to tie for the lead of the tournament. And I started doing it for two or three times a week. So 12 years later, after nobody had ever said a word, I'm in Palm Springs, and I'm having lunch with Joe Walser and Ernie Vossler. I thought to myself, I have got to tell Mr. Vossler this story. He is not going to believe what I used to do. So I told him the story. You know, I used to park my car in Portland, carry across the field there. And he goes, "Yeah, and you'd pitch your clubs across the fence there on 11 and play the backside, 11 through 17. I was in shock. I looked at him and I said, "You knew?" He goes, "Of course I knew. You did it two or three times a week." And I said, "Well, why didn't you send somebody down to throw me off? I was trespassing." He said, "You were a good kid. You weren't bothering anybody. You were just trying to get better." And that's the kind of golf pros we had in Oklahoma City during that time.
Well, that's a fabulous story, and influential golf professionals. And in the case of Ernie Vossler, Joe Walser, they went on to develop fantastic golf courses, Oak Tree Golf Club in Edmond, where you grew up, and yes. PGA West out in the desert that you mentioned. And then you came across and developed a wonderful relationship with another iconic figure, in Roger Penske, in the automotive business. Yes. I know you two played a lot of golf together. You introduced him to several tour players at the time, who I'm sure were fascinated by that need for speed. How did you get to know Mr. Penske? And you've got to have a great story about the one and only Roger Penske.
Well, I do. It's one of my best. We were at the IVB Philadelphia Golf Classic in the mid-70s, 75, 76, along in there. And we were in the locker room after our practice round with Bruce Litsky and Bill Rogers and Bob Gilder and George Cadle was in there. We're always talking about cars, all of us guys. And so Litsky says, Roger Penske's race shop is just up the road, not too far from here. Edwards, why don't you call him and go up there and offer to buy one of his IROC Camaro race cars? That'd look real good in your garage. And I said, well, one would look real good in your garage too, Bruce, you know. But I'll go up there. So I got on the phone, and I called Penske Racing, and a lady answered the phone, Penske Racing. I said, my name's Danny Evers. I'm a golf pro down here in Philadelphia. Is Mr. Penske available? And she said, well, just a moment, please. Not 5 seconds later, a voice comes on the phone. Hello, this is Roger Penske. So I don't even hardly know what to say. Mr. Penske, I'm Danny Evers. I'm a golf pro. We're down here in Philadelphia. I got some buddies. We'd love to come up there and look at the car, the IROC Camaros you have for sale. And he said, well, yeah, that'd be great. He said, why don't you guys come on up about 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? So we drove up, and Roger showed us all around the race shop. It was absolutely as clean as a whistle. You could have eaten off the floors. The crew guys were so great. They were asking for our autographs, and we were asking for their autographs. And after a couple of hours there, Mr. Penske said, Danny, come on down to my office. So we sat in there, just the two of us, and he said, do you play in the Bing Crosby golf tournament? I said, oh, I love to play the Crosby out at Pebble Beach, one of my favorite tournaments. He said, well, do you have a partner? And I go, well, no, not really. And he said, well, would you like to play together? And I just about choked. I couldn't even get a word out fast enough. I said, Mr. Penske, I'd love to play with you. He said, Roger, please, Roger. I said, okay, Roger, let's do it. That'll be a lot of fun. So he says to me then, he says, have you ever been to a NASCAR race? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, well, why don't you come to Phoenix this fall? I'll get you all set up. And we'll have a great time out there. So I fly to Phoenix. He got me a hotel room out there in Litchfield Park. So I go in to register that night at the hotel. And it's about 10 o'clock, a little bit after 10. And so I register, and the guy behind the counter had kind of a look on his face, a little bit funny. And he said, there's a message from Mr. Penske here for you, Mr. Edwards. And I said, okay. So I opened up the note. And it said, Dear Danny, glad you made it. We're going to have a great time this weekend. Call me in the morning at 7:36. And I look up at the guy behind the counter, and he's looking right at me, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders, you know, like, that's what he said. So that was my first indication of the schedule that one RP, Roger Penske, ran on. But we had a great time that weekend.
Well, I'll tell you what, speaking of a great time, Kelly, you know, I've made a career out of asking people questions. I'm kind of flabbergasted that there's only one person in the world that I could ask the following question to, because nobody else could give me a proper answer. And the question, Danny, is, are there similarities between playing golf at an elite level, five-time winner on the PGA Tour, and driving fast cars in competition?
Bob, I think probably the only comparison would be the focus that you have to do both at a very high level, professional level. Driving a race car is an absolute total focus. You've got cars all around you. You're going triple-digit speeds. In my case, you're going around turns at 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 miles an hour that you're not supposed to be able to get through a turn at that speed. And you've got cars all around you that are trying to get you off the road and get ahead of you. On the golf cart, of course, it's a little quieter. You got guys that are trying to beat you and trying to score a little lower, but they're not going to come over and whack you on the side of the head with a golf club or something. So you don't have to worry about physical injury. But you've got to be on the top of your game. You've got to be thinking about what you're doing, the situation, the conditions, the altitude, the grass, the lie, how you feel, all of those kinds of things you've got to be thinking of. And you don't get but about 10, 15, 20 seconds each time it's your turn to hit, to go through that whole list to be able to achieve victory at golf. So in that way, they are similar. Total focus.
I want to ask Danny something about, he goes overseas. You go overseas for the first time, what, I believe it was 1973. You're playing the Open Championship. You're the low amateur.
Yes.
What do you remember about that experience playing golf overseas versus playing golf in the U.S.?
Bob, this is one of my best stories. I come out to the golf course in Edmond at Kicking Bird, and I tell Art Proctor, our golf professional there, who, this isn't when I'm in college, my second year, sophomore year, and he says, well, you're going to go to the British Open, Danny? I said, well, I'd love to go play at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's. I'd love to go to the British Open, but I can't afford to go over there. And he said, are you coming out here tomorrow? And I said, sure. He said, be here about 12 o'clock. So I show up, and he said, Danny, I want you to meet Dr. Rex Kenyon. I said, Dr. Kenyon, nice to meet you. He says, well, so Art tells me you want to go to the British Open. I said, well, I'd love to go, but I can't afford to go. And he says, well, how much do you think it would cost to go over there? Of course, I had no idea, never been hardly out of Oklahoma, so I just sort of threw out a number, well, $500, I guess, you know, airfare, food, you know, it's 2 weeks, I got to qualify. If I make the qualifier, it's the second week. So he says, I want you to go qualify for the British Open. So I'm standing there thinking, Bob, this man has just said he wants to send me to the British Open and give me $500. So I go to the British Open. I qualify in the qualifier the first week. I was third low qualifier, four courses, 125 players at each course for 24 spots. So I'm in the British Open. So I'm over at Royal Lytham St. Anne's. I'm standing there. I've gotten a locker from some little short guy that spoke this language that I didn't even understand. And I'm out on the practice range looking at the grandstand, and I'm thinking to myself, there is not one person in Edmond, Oklahoma that can even imagine what I'm getting to do here. So I'm standing there, and a lady comes walking over, nicely dressed, and she says, are you Danny Edwards? I said, yes, ma'am. She says, are you playing a practice round? We saw that you had an opening in your tee time. I said, well, yes. She says, we have a friend here that would like to join you, if that's possible. I said, of course. I said, who is it? He said, his name is Bobby Locke. And I thought to myself, Bobby Locke, that's the guy from South Africa that's supposed to be that great putter. And so he comes walking over. And, of course, he's got his plus fours on with the white socks and the white shoes and his long-sleeve white dress shirt with a tie tucked inside the front button there. And he says, Danny, my name is Bobby Locke. Thank you for letting me join you. Are you ready to go? I said, yes, sir, I'm ready. Let's go. So we tee off. I'm playing a round of golf, a practice round at the British Open in 1972 with my buddy, with a guy who is an unbelievable player, Bobby Locke. What I remember most about that day was his putting. And it looked like, when I finally could describe it, that there was a magnet in the hole. And his ball would roll toward the hole, and it was like a magnet was drawing it to the hole, because it went in the high side, it went in the low side, the ball went in the back side. It went in places I'd never seen a golf ball go in the hole, like there was just a funnel down there that was pulling it toward the hole. Unbelievable. So I get to play a practice round in the British Open with Bobby Locke. Fortunately, I was the only player to make both cuts. I get to sit on the dais on the 18th green, sitting beside Tom Watson and Johnny Miller. And I think Lee Trevino was runner-up that year, and received the silver medal. And I thought to myself again, there's not anybody in Edmond, Oklahoma that has any earthly idea what I'm getting to do.
I'll tell you what I would have done. The minute my round with Bobby Locke was complete, I'd have put my clubs down. I'd have waved goodbye. I'd have flown back to the United States. I never would have hit another golf ball in my life. I mean, what an experience. I mean, what a truly remarkable experience.
Unbelievable.
Kelly, why don't you wrap this up? Because I'm here at the PGA Championship, having just met Danny Edwards, but I can tell you this much. I could talk to him for the next 5 hours, and it wouldn't be enough, but it wouldn't be fair to our listeners. Wrap it up, my friend.
Well, it has been a great visit. Danny, your new book, Driven, is, you know, chronicles your life as a tour player, race car driver, But give us kind of a quick summation, if you would. You decided to put your focus on launching Royal Grip, the golf grip company, and you were also very much involved in something called the Tour Players Association, which people today can kind of relate to, I imagine, a little bit with a number of these PGA Tour players possibly looking to leave for the LIV Invitational Golf Series. Talk just a little bit about Royal Grip and why you decided to go that way, and then the Tour Players Association.
Well, I will, Kelly. Thanks. I always enjoyed business, but toward the end of the 15, 16 years on the tour, I just didn't feel like I just didn't make enough putts to really compete for major championships, and that was really my goal. So I decided to take a sabbatical and start a business. Golf Pride made grips that wore out real fast, and I thought there would be a way to make a grip that would last a lot longer. So we pioneered and studied for 2 years rubber compounding, vertical injection molding. So started Royal Grip, had a great run with that, making a million grips a month, all sold out our door. And then, of course, I decided after 5 years I started missing playing and I wanted to get back, get ready for the Champions Tour. So pretty much sold Royal Grip, had kind of a manufacturing disaster that was a heartbreaker. But I got back to the tour, and immediately when I got back, the players said, "Danny, we've got things going on out here that aren't right. We don't get enough information about our tour and where the money comes, where it goes, that kind of thing." And I said, "Look, guys, I just want to play golf, try to get my gear." "Oh, you're a businessman. You're the right guy to head this up." And I said, "No, I put them off for a year or so." And finally, I decided, "All right, I'll do it for 2 years." So in those 2 years, we had some very interesting times. We never were allowed any access to the information of how our tour operated financially, where the money came from, where it went. It was a very difficult time. I got pot shots from the tour leadership and letters that were stuffed in players' lockers over another player's name that they never saw, and it was a pretty frustrating time. And I was ready to give up or ready to pass on the baton, and had a young man that was going to take over, and his name happened to be Payne Stewart. And so we spent a lot of time together, and we had set up a press conference, a national press conference in Houston for the tour championship, and I was getting ready to fly down there on a Sunday evening to meet Payne in the morning and introduce him as the new head of the TPA. And I'm on the phone with one of the lawyers for our side, and he gets on the call, and someone says, "Payne Stewart is on an airplane that is flying out of control in the Midwest." So when that plane went down, the TPA ended. And it was an incredibly unfortunate situation, but we made some progress. We did learn a few things, not what we wanted, but we did learn some things. So it's a kind of a deja vu now with what's going on as I look back at some of those times.
Well, it was an unbearable loss when Payne perished with others in that plane. But I will say that it's been for us today, for Bob and me, just an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Danny, to hear these terrific stories. The new book is just out, Driven, the Danny Edwards Story. Please give our listeners an idea of where they can go to purchase it.
Sure, Kelly. It's on Amazon, on Kindle, a couple of those others that you can find it on. I'm proud of it, and Bob's work with me, Bob Denny's work with me. There's so many more stories. I wish I could tell them all, but you'll get to see them in the book if you get it and read them.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Well, that was a lot of fun hearing from Danny Edwards, his perspective as a really good tour player, a businessman with Royal Grip, and then getting involved in some of the politics of the PGA Tour. Had a very fulfilling life in a lot of ways, and then doing what he did in the fast track. Not, you know, Bob, not exactly something that a lot of PGA Tour players are thinking of, getting behind a really fast automobile.
No, and speaking of fast, I have to wrap it up because I got to go pack. And where am I packing to go? St. Andrews in Scotland, one of my favorite places. And I can't wait to report on Musings on Sports, all that goes on at St. Andrews. I think it's going to be a magical, magical week, and I certainly appreciate everybody listening.
It's going to be a great week. Thanks to Danny Edwards again for joining us. And as we anticipate the 150th Open Championship, please join us next week on Musings on Sports. Dan Hicks, the voice of NBC Sports Golf, will be our guest. Lots to talk about with Dan, about his career heading into the 150th Open Championship. Please enjoy listening to Musings on Sports wherever you enjoy your podcast. For my dear friend Bob Bupka, whose heart is already in St. Andrews, Kelly Elvin signing off, Musings on Sports.